This Week in Palestine offers news from both a Palestinian perspective and a global perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. Good morning. Good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Bethany Marks, and I welcome you back to another episode of This Week in Palestine. As always, we keep our focus on Gaza and the West Bank, because while the headlines shift, the suffering remains. The world watches, yet the violence continues. Today is Sunday, June 8, 2025, and the question persists: what will it take for global outrage to transform into real action? Stay with us for a great discussion as we unpack the unfolding events. I want to take a moment to highlight an urgent call to action. The Standout to Stop the Killing takes place every Tuesday from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. at the Zionist Consulate, 20 Park Plaza, Boston. Your presence makes a difference. Raise your voice. Stand for justice. Today, we tune in to a thought-provoking discussion from This Is Not a Watermelon. This conversation features Mikey Muhana in dialogue with his guest Frank Barat, a French activist, author, and producer widely recognized for his advocacy on Palestinian rights and global justice. Frank Barat served as the coordinator of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine from 2008 to 2014, a platform dedicated to examining Israel's violations of international law. Over the years, he has collaborated with prominent figures including Noam Chomsky, Ilan Papp, Ken Loach, and Angela Davis, working to elevate conversations around Palestinian struggles, resistance, and international solidarity. His body of work includes Gaza in Crisis, On Palestine, and Freedom is a Constant Struggle, all of which contribute to the global understanding of the Palestinian cause. Through his writings, films, and public advocacy, Frank Barat remains a powerful voice for Palestinian liberation, challenging media bias, state propaganda, and systems of oppression. Let's listen in to this crucial discussion.
Welcome to another episode of This Is Not a Watermelon. My name is Mikey Mhenna. Today on the series, we have Frank Barat, who is a writer, an editor, an activist, filmmaker, whose work has been focused on Palestine and global solidarity, sort of, I think, justice movements more broadly. Frank has been part of a lot of different books that you probably are heard of, including On Palestine with Noam Chomsky and Ilan Pappe, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, A Struggle Makes Us Human, a lot of different stuff. Frank, welcome to the series.
Hey, hi, Mikey, and thanks for having me on.
I should say before we get started that we're recording this on April 18th, Friday, April 18th. I'm not sure when this is coming out, but just so you know, those of you who are listening. Frank, let me just start with a basic question. Why do you care about Palestine? How did that start?
Okay, it's an interesting one because a lot of people actually have asked me about this over the last 20 years that I've been kind of politically active on the issue. And I'm going to try to make a long story short. This is something I'm still sort of thinking about it myself and trying to understand. I think the I was raised in a family of like six. I've got five brothers and sisters, you know, kind of proletarian. You know, my dad is a worker, and my mom, you know, we were not rich. So I think the kind of injustice question in terms of our daily lives when I was young and stuff was always something that I was aware of. And I guess when I saw injustices towards others, I also felt like kind of a duty to stand in solidarity with them from a very young age. When it comes to Palestine, and I'm now jumping about 20 years, when it comes to Palestine, I became really aware of Palestine late, very late. I think I was about 27. Obviously, I knew, like a lot of people, what Palestine was. I was aware that there was an issue there. There was a conflict, you know.
For context, you grew up in France.
Yeah, I grew up in France. Yeah. And actually, it's interesting because it's when I moved to London that Palestine became a lot clearer in my head. So anyway, when I moved to London, I was about 20 years old. I started years after, around 26 years old, getting involved with like local Palestine solidarity campaign chapters. You know, you distribute leaflets outside the underground, you organize small events, film screenings and stuff. But the and again, I'm trying to make a long story short.
Yeah.
The first time I went to Palestine was 2007. And it was really the sort of, you know, the moment where my life changed, really. And you know, I think it's Arundhati Roy, the Indian scholar and author, who said that once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. And that's exactly what I felt when I went to Palestine in 2007. And also a lot of Palestinians, I mean, most Palestinians were telling me, you know, it's great that you came, but your job starts when you go back to London or Belgium or France, you know. So
yeah, like when you go is when they give you stuff. When you leave, that's when you actually have to repay that.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I felt that, I'd seen it. I started to properly understand it. And also a lot of the stuff organized before I went, you had always these people telling you, but you've never been. What are you talking about? You don't know. As if we need to have been to a place to know exactly what's happening, you know. But anyway, so yeah, I also
like I know Antarctica is cold.
Yeah, exactly, 100%.
Yeah.
So I felt, but still, I felt a lot stronger. You know, I could tell them, yeah, I've been also on top of watching 200 documentaries and reading 200 reports and stuff. So yeah, 2007 was like a turning point. And Palestine became more and more a part of my life until it became my life. And again, obviously, I'm not like a white savior or anything, but just Palestine became my life, you know, from 2007 onwards. Yeah.
Can you talk about that moment in 2007 and sort of the idea of what you saw that you couldn't unsee?
So it's interesting as well, because, you know, when I went in 2007, I remember telling my friends and family and stuff, and people were worried, right? You know, you're going for them into a war zone in a way. I was also worried, you know, I'd never been to like a whatever dangerous place, and I also went in my head at the time. I was like a sort of, you know, it's a conflict, two-state solution. Obviously, I called myself pro-Palestinian, but I still this vision of like, you know, they both need a state, etc. And so I went with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, you know, led by Jeff Halper. So we had like, it was called like a study tour. So we had 10 days in the West Bank, also in Palestine 48, also known as Israel. And we met lots of Palestinians, NGOs, charities, also Israelis, obviously progressive Israelis. And I saw, you know, we went obviously through many checkpoints. I was going to, I went to Bilayin twice because I stayed for 2 Fridays for the, you know, the demonstrations against the wall. And I think what touched me, and it's very important for the rest of my political journey, is stories. You know, I saw people that lived through the most horrific stuff, but the stories, like human stories, really, really touched me. And also when I went in 2007, I had bought like a mini DV camera, camcorder. So I filmed a lot of interviews with internationals, with people in my group, also with Palestinians, also with a few Israelis, and actually made a film myself that I edited myself that I called 9 Days in Palestine. The interesting part is when I came back to London and when I saw my family in France and stuff, they were like, so how was it? You know, it's a war zone. What did you see? What, you know, and I had a massive smile on my face all the time. And I said, I think I've spent some of the best days of my life. It was so much joy, so much humor, so much beauty, so much amazing food. And I also realized that, you know, because we see Palestine as this war zone, we forget, people don't realize how beautiful Palestinians are, the foodies, the landscapes are. And And that also made me realize that the struggle, the way the Palestinians live the struggle, is also beautiful and exhilarating, you know, and there's a lot of joy in the struggle. So, yeah, and again, to cut a long story short, the funny thing is when I came back and I talked to my parents and my friends about what I saw, they still wouldn't believe it because it was too crazy. They were like, this is mad. What are you talking about? Like, you're telling me there's Israeli snipers in the watchtowers shooting at kids playing football in Aida refugee camp near Bethlehem. I was like, yeah, that's what happening. You know, they just couldn't, you know, there is like, I guess, images and reality when it comes to Palestine. They couldn't work it out, you know. So, yeah, that was like part of my journey and duty was firstly to convince my friends and my close circle that what was happening was, you know, very one-sided in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about that, sort of the obligation, the responsibility of that, right? Like you see this, you go back to France. How do you translate that into action?
Yeah, that's very interesting. That's so crucial because like right now, obviously we've been not living, but we've been witnessing a genocide live on our screens and a lot of people are feeling paralyzed, useless. They really don't know where to start, what to do to show support for Palestine. And but when I came back, I wanted to tell the stories first. And I thought, this is the way I'm going to touch people. So again, I'd filmed about 45 interviews with like, you know, healthcare workers, with, you know, random people in the streets, with bakers, with teachers, with activists. So I started to show, so I made this little film called 9 Days in Palestine, and I started to show it to people, to friends, organize little screenings, like 15 people in London, you know. And I started writing also about what I saw, and I started, so this was the first step, was like, I wasn't sure what I could do, but I was sure that just telling the stories that I saw was, you know, the first step. But then very, very quickly, I got involved. So I went to Palestine in 2007. I think mid-2008, I got involved with an initiative called the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, which was a very big initiative. The Russell Tribunal has got a long history of like popular citizens tribunal in regards to Vietnam, to Latin America and the rest. And I became involved and I became the coordinator of this project. And this transformed again my life, and this transformed the way I could be politically active, because like the Russell Tribunal was like putting lawyers with activists, with filmmakers, with cultural figures together in the same room and think about what can we do for Palestine. So this was really another sort of life-changing moment for me.
I want to talk specifically about the Russell Tribunal. If you go to the about page, the first line is, may this tribunal prevent the crime of silence. Talk a little bit about what that, the history of the tribunal, it's a technical authority and it's aspirational authority.
It's very interesting you quoting this the man. It's actually Bertrand Russell who said that, you know, and I hadn't really thought about it until today. And today it's, you know, it's very relevant as well. You know, the crime of silence, you know, being silent is being complicit. There's no two ways about it. Once you know, you have to speak out one way or another. And so the tribunal comes from a long history of like popular tribunals that started in 1968 with the British philosopher Bertrand Russell and the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre about the US aggression, war of aggression in Vietnam. And then you had in the 70s tribunals around military juntas in Latin America, Pinochet, Videla, etc. as well. And this idea of like citizens, popular tribunals became a way for people, and it's very important to tell their stories. You know, I think people don't understand that once you, if you are being oppressed, colonized, tortured, one of the hardest thing, and we're seeing it again with Gaza, is people not believing that you really are, you know. So just being able to tell your story, this is what's happening in front of a platform, was key. And a lot of Palestinians were saying, just being able to tell my story is really, really crucial. So that this was like one of the really very important step of the tribunal. But the tribunal was very legalistic as well. So on the jury and on the legal team, we had the most sort of well-known jury of a former jurist of the UN, of like Belgian courts, French courts, Spanish courts. So the idea was to say, we have international law. You know, this was decided by the powerful states, but you're not implementing it when it comes to Palestine. So can we use what you've put in place to show that if international law was actually implemented, what could happen? So we raised, and we also, we started from the point that Israel is guilty. The tribunal was never about, is Israel guilty of colonizers, you know, colonization or occupation? We were like, there's, you know, ample evidence that...
Yeah, it's self-evident.
Yeah. So we addressed third-party complicity. So institutions that are complicit in the occupation, states that are complicit in the occupation, people that are complicit in the occupation, and corporations. I think maybe I've said it already, but corporations. So each session had a very specific goal. And so we had, yeah, one session in London, one in Barcelona, one in Cape Town, one in New York, and two in Brussels. In New York, we addressed US complicity and the UN role as well. In South Africa, it was very different because we decided to touch upon the apartheid analogy. And this was very interesting because a lot of the people wanted us to focus on apartheid in the West Bank, but we really pushed to have a broader overview of apartheid towards the Palestinian people, which meant in historical Palestine, but also in the diaspora, etc. And then I'll shut up. But the interesting part is that when Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch released their reports on apartheid, which was 3 years ago, maybe now, or two, 3 years ago, their reports were incredibly similar that the report we released about 10 years earlier. And our reports, again, were not like two pages. You know, on average, there were about 120 pages. So, and what's interesting as well, when you see the South Africa case against Israel at the ICJ, a lot of the team, the South African team, was part of the legal advising committee of the Russell Tribunal, you know. So, yeah, in a nutshell, that this was what the tribunal was about. And also, sorry, maybe that's one of the most important thing of the tribunal. It was to put people together. So we had like national organizing committees in Ireland, in Spain, in the US, in Palestine. And then for 3 days, you had all these people together. So there was a lot of side meetings, workshops, you know, between the sessions and stuff. And it created, I think, this network that we still use today. And also a network of legal advisors and a network of cultural figures and personalities, which, yeah.
How resilient do you think that network has proved to be, especially now in the last like few months? You see this insane legal campaign against not even activists, against anyone who's just holding space for conversation in academia in the US. There's been basically almost McCarthy era style witch hunt basically in Europe. How have those networks actually proven to be effective or not as effective as we need them to be?
Yeah, I'm not sure we can talk about effectiveness because in terms of concrete results and victories, it'll be a stretch to say that we've achieved a lot. But for example, a lot of the people now in Palestine Legal or like people like Noura Erekat was in the Russell Tribunal. She's now fighting for, you know, for justice towards Palestinians in the US. Michael Mansfield, KC, has just launched this legal action against 10 British, you know, dual national that served in Gaza. He was one of the jury members of the tribunal. Daniel Makova, a legal expert, has been key in all the like universal jurisdiction cases. John Reynolds, an Irish lawyer, is incredibly involved in like, you know, 10 cases all around the world. So, and they work together. And this was the thing about the tribunal as well. They know each other now. They work together. They make, and it makes the work they do a lot more a lot easier once you know people, and a lot stronger, I think. So like just these people that were part of the tribunal, obviously were active before the tribunal. I'm not saying the tribunal like opened their eyes. But I mean, again, John Dugard was one of the guys behind the ICJ case. There is also ideas of new sort of citizens' popular tribunals, and it's the same people, again, involved in them. And in terms also of, I think, let's say call them celebrities, artists, filmmakers, and I think what the tribunal did, and also because we were strategic enough to approach them with international law. You know, it was like, we're not going to be like the very radical activists talking right away about apartheid, about genocide. We're going to tell you, this is the law. We're using the law as the platform. Some people that were active at the time became incredible allies in the last 10 years in regards to Palestine. There are lots of them, but, you know, like Ken Loach and Roger Waters, Angela Davis, Alice Walker, all these people, like, are in terms of celebrities, are at the forefront now. And I think the tribunal also gave them this like grounding of you know, and it was like also kind of, it was very educational, I think, for a lot of people, including myself. You know, I hung out lawyers and barristers for like 8 years. So, yeah.
I'm curious about these, like, I remember a friend of mine who I used to teach with, he always used to talk about like, how can we turn moments into movements, right? And there's like, in the course of my lifetime, there have been all these moments, right? And that have gone viral before, sort of, even before like this type of virality. Sheikh Jarrah is a really important one. It's a really important moment. It's one that obviously you've been connected to as well. Can you talk a little bit about the impact that it had on you specifically, and how it sort of, I think, began this like this phase of the global solidarity movement for Palestine?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember like in 2007, so when I went to Palestine for the first time, we went to Sheikh Jarrah, we visited Sheikh Jarrah, and the thing is, I'm not sure people realize how crazy this is, right? When you go to Sheikh Jarrah, you have Palestinians that have lived there for like ever, and you really have like, you know, Jewish settlers from Brooklyn that speak American saying, you know, this is my house, you know, fuck off. You know, it just doesn't, it's crazy. Like, in a way, Israel is when you know, you strip it to its core, is really a crazy concept, you know, and it's, yeah, Sheikh Jarrah was momentous in I think, you know, and I mean, the ripples of Sheikh Jarrah are felt to today as well. I mean, for me, honestly, personally, a moment, and I think maybe because Sheikh Jarrah was kind of the beginning of my journey, but very quickly in 2008, 2009, you had Operation Cast Lead, as Israel calls it, which was the first really major operation in Gaza since 2005. I was also involved around this time with the flotilla, because one of the first flotillas, I mean, they arrived in Gaza before Operation Cast Lead with the boats. And I remember that during and after Operation Cast Lead, which lasted about 3 weeks, which, you know, killed about 1,300 Palestinians, we felt as activists, as a community of activists, there would be a before and an after Gaza 2008, 2009. This is a moment where, you know, Israel shot itself in the foot. It's so blatant and obvious now what Israel is about. And you had also massive demonstrations at the time all over the world and stuff. But I think we were aware at the time that if we don't do our job, it's down to us. I mean, you know, there's going to be a before and after Gaza if we do our job. We're not, you know, the politicians, the institutions, the media are not going to do it. And we were always, again, aware that if we, I mean, like, it's too harsh to say if we don't do our job properly, but we were always aware that potentially in 6 months, in a year, Gaza 2008, 2009 would have been forgotten, and Israel would be, again, like a normal state. And this is what happened. And I mean, you mentioned it over and over again, you know. And we are at this moment now, again. Maybe we'll talk about it. I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but yeah.
The flotillas, I think I mean, I don't remember all the details of the flotillas, and I'm sure that a lot of people listening don't. Can you just like add some details? Like, how does that type of activism start? I mean, is there basically like essentially WhatsApp groups and email chains saying, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is where we're fundraising for this. We're going to actually dedicate our bodies and put our bodies in harm's way to make this statement.
So I wasn't directly involved in the first one. I wasn't involved in, you know, the planning and stuff of the first one, which was in 2008, and which brought a few people, including Eva and Quiva and Alberto and Vittorio to Gaza. But I was very quickly involved with the rest of the Freedom Flotilla process. And so I know that it started with a lot of former ISM members. So ISM is the International Solidarity Movement. And I think it came out of a point of, and we've all been through this, I think, in the last 18 months, of kind of desperation. We have the big demonstrations, we have the lobbying, we have the petitions, we have the cultural actions and stuff, but this is not enough. What can we do to, I mean, look, you know, in the last 18 months, I was like, I think if I didn't have kids, I didn't have like a family life and stuff, I would have tried to go to Gaza. I don't know what for, but like, you know, it's so maddening that you feel like you have to put your body on the line. And I think that's what came with the flotillas as well, to say like, let's stop this. Let's use our privileges as white European Americans, Irish, you know, and go there. You know, maybe, you know, it was out of this, maybe they will stop. Maybe at least we will avoid more people getting killed. So yeah, it was a massive initiative. I mean, in terms of operations, logistical, crazy fucking initiative. Sorry, by the way, for swearing.
No,
but anyway,
okay.
crazy initiative, which involved like boats coming from pretty much all over Europe, going to Cyprus or Greece, and then sailing to Gaza. You know, this is mad. Like, you are like, so complicated, infiltrated by whatever, the Mossad or others, that just, you know, made some of the boats impossible to continue, and then called on countries to make sure we couldn't use the flag of the country on the boat to actually leave Cyprus or Greece. It all came to a very big moment in 2010 with what's called now the Mavi Marmara flotilla. And people maybe don't remember, but this was I still have goosebumps because it was an incredible moment of solidarity. You had a boat from Turkey called the Mavi Marmara. We're talking a massive boat, 800 people on it, like, you know, one of those cruise boats, pretty much, like, you know. And you had, I can't remember now how many boats around the Mavi Marmara, which was smaller in size. You had people from all over the world. You had like Nobel Prize winners on the boat. You had like, you know, celebrities on boats, and they all sailed towards Gaza. And this is important to understand Israel's impunity. Israel's commandos boarded the big boat, the Mavi Marmara, using helicopters. You have commandos, you know, coming down from helicopters. They boarded the Mavi Marmara, killed 9 people, including 1 Turkish American citizen. Some of them killed, like, you know, how you call that? Very short, point blank range. And arrested tens of others, you know, beat them up, confiscated all their recording equipment, phones, cameras, you know, camcorders, to also, and that's another point, control what's coming out of this, you know, control the information. If you control the first 48 hours, you're kind of safe. Tortured a few people psychologically. And this was another moment where we thought, actually, you know what, as bad as we knew Israel could be, all of us were shocked. You know, just imagine, they're coming on a boat, which is a Turkish NGO boat. They kill 9 people. Obviously, no one was armed, right? It was like activists. This was a moment of like, we are facing this lunatic state, this monster, out of control monster. And again, unfortunately, not much happened after that. I mean, there's a lot of legal cases and stuff, you know, that lasted years and cost people hundreds of thousands of dollars. But Israel came out of it, again. And then I think there was another one, another flotilla. But then, I mean, the organizing committee realized that if Israelis are really actually ready to kill activists, maybe the flotillas are not like kind of worth it anymore. It's just too dangerous. So I think there was another flotilla which you couldn't even, like, they arrived in international waters. Israel, like, intercepted the boats, boarded the boats, put everyone in jail, sent everyone back. So because it was such a big initiative in terms of finances as well and funding, I think it was then decided to stop it for a while. I know it's kind of started again with Gaza now. But the fact that the flotilla, which people have been talking about this time around, hasn't left for Gaza yet shows how difficult it is.
Yeah.
On all aspects. Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, we can't beat them in the courts because the courts are rigged. None of the laws apply for some reason. There's this like illogical loophole where none of these laws apply.
Right.
And then you can't throw your bodies in front of them because the flotilla example is one of them, right? Then there's a question of, okay, can you convince Israelis that the nature of the state, the manifestation of this idea, is unjust from within? And the two books that you've written with Noam Chomsky and Ilan Pappe, I think, try to do that. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about those projects, and your relationship with these people.
Yeah. So first, I think we can beat Israel in the courts, but it's not about the courts in a way. It's about the application of the verdicts of the court. You know, the ICJ has been very clear, you know, no negotiations, nothing until the occupation ends. You know, it's very clear. First, you
get out. But
they
don't have the power, right? Courts don't have
exactly.
powers unless you have security apparatus. So this,
And it's down now, you know, once the court come back with a verdict, it's down to states to follow the courts. And we've seen with the ICC how political those courts are and the states that are obligated under their own laws to implement the findings that they don't implement when it comes to Israel. It's mad. I think you're right, like putting your body on the line also it's maybe, you know, we're not really useful once we're dead or on our knees or in jail, I feel. So, and then I'll address your question, of course, but I think what we have for sure is the moral high ground. And I think that what's been happening in the last 18 months is so clear. We are in a moment of extreme clarity. And I think that that's it. Palestine will never be forgotten. They're trying to, you know, make Palestinians disappear. They're trying to say they don't exist. But it's over now. Whatever happens, Palestine will be in people's minds. I mean, I was, you know, I've been on demonstration for 20 years and I've never seen demonstrations like in the last 18 months. First, people that I've never been, who have never organized a demonstration, don't realize how much work goes into organizing one demo. Organizing one demo every week for 18 months is incredible. It's an incredible show of, like, you know, solidarity and the people in the demonstrations. I mean, I was in Paris. I've never seen demonstrations so colorful, so creative, with, you know, people from Congo, with the LGBTQI movement or whatever, you know. So I think Palestine has become, and people have realized that it's become this, like, you cannot not talk about Palestine anymore. But to come to your question, I have no hope whatsoever that the change will come from inside. And it's not me saying it. I told you in 2007, I went with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition. They had an office in West Jerusalem, which is, you know, where Israeli lives, you know, Israeli Jews anyway. And Jeff Halper years ago, told me we closed the office. No one's interested anymore. We have no Israelis coming to say what's happening, what's wrong with Palestine. So, you know, he was like, hope that the change will come from within is dead. Obviously, there are amazing Israeli activists, but they're so few. They're so oppressed, repressed. A lot of them have had to leave Israel. I don't think, even though, I mean, you know, in the last few weeks, we've seen a lot of reservists of the Israeli army refusing to go to Gaza. We've seen, they had a letter about, like yesterday, of 1,000 of them, you know, calling for the war in Gaza to end. You have the British Board of Deputies in the UK, which is a very Zionist board, coming out with a letter yesterday, 32 of them saying, like, we don't stand behind Israel's action in Gaza anymore. But the premises, I mean, you have like hundreds of thousands of Israelis in the streets, but the premises are not right, right? They're not asking for an end of the occupation. They're not asking for the end of apartheid. They're asking for an end of the war because too many of our soldiers are being killed and we have hostages left. So I think the moment of reckoning in Israel has not arrived yet. And I think that, and people have to understand how the Israeli project, the Zionist project, is a very successful one. You know, the way they have framed who they are, what they represent, is, you know, people in Israel, Israeli Jews, are brainwashed from a very, very early age. And my friend Nurit Peled, who is an Israeli academic, wrote about this when she wrote, like, Palestinians or Arabs in Israeli school books. As soon as you can read, as soon as you can see, everything is created to make you believe that your neighbor next door, if he's Arab, is the enemy and wants you dead. And in Israel, military service is compulsory. It's 3 years and it's at 18 years old. Like, you know, usually, like, I lived in France when I was due to do my military service. I was studying. So they were like, oh, as long as you study, you don't go to the army. In Israel, you go to the army as soon as you finish, like, school. And it's also understandable, right? When you're 18 and you haven't gone abroad, you haven't been to university, you're the most
impressionable point of your life. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And just realize that if you have been brainwashed from like 5 years old until 18, and at 18, we put you in the West Bank, in Hebron, in Halil, with an MS-16, and you are surrounded by people that we have told you from 5 years old onwards are animals who wants you dead. You know, first you have, like, breaking the silence, you know, this Israeli NGO, fear is incredible. If you are scared and you have an M16 in your hand, you shoot at everything that moves. And we've seen it in Gaza as well when they killed Israeli hostages nearly a year ago now. So there is this fear and this, yeah, completely brainwashed nation. And I think also it's down to cognitive dissonance. When you think what you believe in is right, and when you've been thinking like this for like 50 years, it's a lot easier to keep thinking it's right than to, because knowing the truth, your world will collapse, right? You have to rethink everything, your relationship with others, what you are on earth for. So I think a lot of people are refusing to, in a way, admit what's happening. But I don't know. I'm pretty sure saying so that Gaza this time would have opened the eyes of a few Israelis anyway. And to, oh yeah, because I didn't address the book.
No. Sorry, I want to talk a little. I love what you're saying in terms of like, it's such an interesting perspective and obviously an informed one. Then I'm curious about who these books are for. Who is it like Ilan Pappe talking to when he writes these books? I mean, obviously it's a book between a conversation between Noam Chomsky and Ilan Pappe. Mm-hmm. You're editing both of them. Who are they for?
It's a very interesting question. So remember that these books, the first one, Gaza in Crisis, I think was in 2008.
Yeah. Published in 2010.
2010. Yeah. So we worked on it like 2008, 2009 or something, which is like 15 years ago, I guess. Yeah. 15, 16 years ago. I mean, these books came out of like nowhere really. I mean, for me, like the way I discovered, I understood Palestine did start with Chomsky, his book, Understanding Power. Ilan Pappe quickly arrived after that in terms of, you know, which also shows that the way I understood Palestine was from two Jewish thinkers, including one Israeli Jew. And it shows how racist also academia is and you know, the publishing world is. that you had many, many Palestinian voices that could have opened my eyes, but it's two Jewish guys that did. And we spoke about this. I remember because, so I did a short interview with Noam Chomsky, which was mad for me. I was like, you know, it was for Palestine News, the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, kind of little, you know, fanzine kind of stuff. It's not a fanzine. You call that a, whatever, the little stuff they were doing.
Zine, yeah.
Yeah. So I emailed Chomsky and he replied, yes, I'll do the interview. We did, you know, ask him like 10 questions online. He answered. And then we started talking on email with Chomsky. And then a publisher told me, why won't you do a short book with Chomsky? And I was like, are you mad? You know, it's Chomsky. Anyway, Chomsky accepted. But then I wanted to have him in conversation with somebody else. I told Noam, like, I want a Palestinian in conversation with you. And remember, this was 2008.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how to put this, but it's like, because it's Chomsky, you can't ever put him with like a 20 years old Palestinian scholar. It wouldn't work. And even the book wouldn't work. So I was like, Noam, I can't think in a way of anyone of like, not your stature, because Chomsky is Chomsky, but that I can put you with in this book. And Chomsky himself said, guess what? Because racism, you know, you have no, you know, why Palestinian scholars are not as well known as me. It's because of the structure and the structural racism. So then, because I knew Ilan a bit, I was, and they had like different point of views, and Chomsky's in the US. Ilan was in Palestine, but then left, but was like a very, very much Israeli Jew. I sort of said, like, maybe we can just, and I mean, Ilan is really the most Palestinian of Israelis I know. Like, you know, it's, so yeah, we put them, I put them together, and this was amazing. But I, at the time, I was like, these two are maybe well known enough for this book to be read. I wasn't sure by whom, but I was like, maybe people, because it's Chomsky, because it's Pape, because they've never done this, like together, this conversation, people read the book. And we wanted a book of interviews as well, because it makes it more like approachable. And, you know, it's not, you know, you can read Pape's Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. It's like 300 pages of like very detailed stuff. I wanted the book to be very, again, yeah, approachable for people. Like, not, you know, approachable isn't the right word, but easy, like an easy read for people to understand very simple question. What is Zionism? What is Israel? What is 48? What is the Nakba? You know, so yeah, I think these books were obviously not addressed to Palestinians or Lebanese or Egyptians, or it was the West, you know, but it wasn't Israelis. We never thought, let's talk to Israelis. You know, it was more the Western white people.
There's this, yeah. There was this interview with Steve Bannon. Do you know who Steve Bannon is?
Yeah.
So there's this interview with Steve Bannon where he's talking to, I forget who he's talking to. I think he's talking to a room of fundraisers. And he's saying, it's not an interview, it's a quote, where he's saying the biggest threat historically, in this moment, the biggest threat to Israel is not activists. It's not Arab activists. It's not the ICJ. These are not the biggest threat. The biggest threat to Israel and to Zionism is liberal Jewish Americans and Europeans, like the not in our name folks, who are saying, wait, hold on. This is not what Judaism is about. This is not what my faith is about. Have you seen, first of all, do you agree with that? Maybe that's the easiest first question. Do you agree with Steve Bannon's estimation?
I mean, like, I agree, of course, that Jewish people saying not in our name is a step in the right direction, of course, because it's all been done, whether they like it or not, under their name, you know, their names. Israel is the self-proclaimed Jewish state. And every time Netanyahu speaks, he said, you know, I'm doing this for the Jewish people. He never mentions Israelis. By the way, people don't know that in Israel, on your ID, you are Jewish or you are Arab, Israeli. You know, in France, you're French. You're not a Jew. In Israel, you're a Jew or you're a Muslim. You know, Israeli is not... There's no nationality in Israel. It's the nation of the Jewish people, you know. So obviously it's crucial And obviously, it helps change the narrative, you know, because people say, people who don't like Israel and its policies are anti-Semites. So once you have, you know, tens of thousands of Jews in the US with Jewish Voices for Peace or others speaking out against that, it's massive. It's massive, of course. And I think, I'm not sure if that's the most dangerous part, because I think Israel has dissociated itself for a long time now from progressive Jews. Israel is a fascist state. Israel is in bed with fascists all over the world. And in the US, they're in bed before being in bed with like the Jewish community of the US, they're in bed with like crazy Christian fundamentalist or fascist. So, and that's what I keep telling people. And I think, you know, Mohamed El Kurd wrote this article again a few months ago. I just forgot the title now, which said that it's not my fault if the settler who was tried to steal my house was a Jew. And by this, he meant if the guy had been Italian, Greek, Spanish, I'd have fought back the same. It's got nothing to do with Jewishness. It's got everything to do with you are stealing my house. And it's got everything to do with fascism. And we're seeing more and more. Israel it's got nothing to do with Jews. Israel is a fascist state. And, you know, they've organized this conference against anti-Semitism in Israel. They've invited all the anti-Semites of this world to attend, you know. So I think the role of Jews is crucial, 100%, and all over the world. And you have lots of organizations that were born in the last 2 years of Jewish activists that are more and more radical. So anti-Zionist Jews, it's not even anti-occupation anymore, it's anti-Zionist Jews. And it's crucial. So on this point, and I think that's probably the only point, I would agree with Steve Bannon.
I want to talk to you a little bit about if you were to like project the next couple decades, which is obviously so hard to do. Obviously, it's a ridiculous premise, but you know, like global politics is shifting clearly, and where every day seems like it's like a year's worth of change. In the solidarity movement more broadly, what does that movement look like when we look eastward or when we look to Africa, where there's all of a sudden like different sources of power, right? If we're moving into a new sort of a Chinese century or a century that's related, where so much power comes from Asia, comes from South Asia, and comes from Africa. What's the solidarity movement look like there? How does it play out there? I mean, we know how it plays out in the US. We know how it plays out in Europe. How does it play out in Asia?
So first, I wanted to say that I was in Paris, like I'm really bad with dates, but I think this was a few months back. There was this massive event called La Fête de l'Humanité. So the Party of Humanity, it's every year, it's formerly the Communist Party, I mean, still the Communist Party organizing it, but it's a really big event. It's hundreds of thousands of people coming over 3 days listening to speeches about, you know, social justice, Palestine,
Congo.
The
Humanity Festival, basically.
Yeah, the Humanity Festival, yeah. Ilan Pappé was invited, and I was moderating his conversation with Omar Somi, a Palestinian. And so we had lunch, and I spoke to Ilan. And I was like, man, Ilan, what the hell is happening? What do we do? I was like, we've lost. And Ilan was like, Frank, like, I'm very pessimistic. This was like at least 6-8 months ago. I'm very pessimistic about the short-term future. But we are, believe me, experiencing the end of Zionism and the end of Israel. And again, when I say the end of Israel, just to make it clear, I don't say like the end of Israelis. I say the end of Israel as an apartheid state. And, you know, it's important to also remind ourselves that history didn't start yesterday. You know, history is a long process, you know, and that the apartheid in South Africa didn't fall in like 10 days. And that what we are seeing now is potentially the end of this crazy, inhumane project. Because, like, how long a state and a people, in a way, based on hatred of pretty much everybody else, can sustain itself. At some point, you know, even as a person, even if like I wake up every morning, Frank, and my primary feeling towards everybody else is hate, you collapse as an individual, right? And so the interesting part is I left this festival and I got on a cab with a Palestinian from Gaza who had left Gaza about 3 months ago. So he had experienced about 6 months of genocide. And he said exactly the same as Ilan. He said, Frank, the next few months, maybe the next few years are going to be really terrible, but Israel is dead. Israel is lost. So that's something. I mean, if an Israeli, if Ilan says it, if a Palestinian from Gaza says it, that we have to try to hold on to, because we're desperate right now to hold on anything that is a bit positive. In terms of the movement, I've got to say that I've got a very, very Euro-centered vision of the movement. You know, I'm French. I live in Belgium. I spent lots of my time in London. I know lots of folks in the US. But I think the Global South, you know, they know what we're talking about because they've experienced it one way or another. The colonized of Algeria, of Tunisia, of Morocco, of South Africa, you know, the former slaves, they've experienced it. And it's so different. And also, you know, what one of the things that's been the hardest for me, and I know for a lot of people, is like you in your house and you seeing what you see, you're experiencing what you're experiencing, you seeing pictures and videos of dead children, of hospitals being bombed, and you leave your house or you leave your little group and you go outside. And I'm talking about this in Europe, right? You go outside and you see people in the streets, you go buy bread, you go buy. And you look at people in the eyes and you feel that they don't see what you see, they don't experience what you experience. It's been like a crushing feeling, honestly, of like, you know. But my mother lives in Morocco. She was born in Morocco. She went back 10 years ago or 15 years ago now. And 2 weeks ago, no, fucking 2 weeks ago, a month ago, we were in Morocco with the kids. And man, looking at people, I was like, we don't have to talk. I know, you know, you know, I know. What do we do now? You know. And this is very important, you know, because it comes from an anti-colonial point of view that we've been so, you know, we've never faced as white Europeans. You know, we've obviously, the others have experienced it, you know, and it's also, I mean, I'm sort of mixing a few things here, but, you know, this resilience of the Palestinian people, this sumud of the Palestinian people, that are sometimes, I hate this word because I'm like, Why should they be resilient? You know,
and like
ask a Palestinian, you know, yeah, you're like, do you want to be resilient? They go, no, I want equality and peace and justice. Fuck me being resilient, you know. But anyway, they are resilient because they've experienced the worst, you know. People of Algeria, people of South Africa, they're resilient because they've built this armor. Because, you know, it's like when you're born, you're a kid, you get all the illnesses you can get because you're, you know, your body's not ready for it. And then you become resilient.
Yeah.
But us white Europeans and stuff are not resilient. And that's why also, like, you know, and it's okay to cry. It's okay to crumble. I've seen so many of my friends like collapsing. I've felt like collapsing a few times. But I'm like, damn, we're collapsing because we're seeing images on the street. We are not resilient. We don't know what the real struggle is. And I think this moment in time, we're going to have to learn, because I think the struggle now, you know, people have this thing about, you know, until now I'm safe, until now I'm safe, until now I'm safe, until now I'm safe. And that's why also they don't sometimes stand in solidarity. They don't, you know, put themselves in danger and stuff. But I think now we're seeing it happening in the US. We're seeing it happening in Europe, the criminalization of protest, of dissent, of pro-Palestine solidarity means that we are now going to face fascism as well, and we are going to have to learn to build this armor because we are facing it. We're going to face it, and we have to learn from these movements. So I think, you know, Asia, Africa, they know. I mean, the fact that South Africa was the country standing up to the rest of the world was so momentous, you know. And actually, an anecdote, when we had a session of the Russell Tribunal in South Africa addressing apartheid, this was the favorite session of everybody that I know, because we went to South Africa, we met with lots of local groups, activists, we went to the townships and stuff, and every time we started to speak to explain what we were doing, they were like, shh, we know, don't, we know what struggling means. We know what armed resistance means. We know what boycott means. And it was like a very important, you know, realization that, yeah, they know. And now we're going to have to learn from them, not obviously us teaching them what resistance is, you know. Yeah.
Before I let you go, can I ask you to give me a recommendation for some books?
Wow. Oh, okay. So I've read this book. I mean, I think a lot of people are talking about it, but I think it touched, anyway, personally, it touched on every point that have been feeling in the last 18 months. And I always get the title wrong. So Omar Al-Akkad, Excuse Me Again. It's, you know, it's like One Day We Will Always Have Been Against This. Wait, I need to get the title, man. So One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. It's by this American Egyptian author called Omar Al-Akkad. It's an incredible book. I just loved it so much because it's just, it talks about this moment. It talks about privileges. It talks about being a brown person in the U.S. It talks about being silent or being vocal in a very beautiful way. And I read it about a month ago, and I just loved it. There are definitely a few others, but I just I can't really remember now.
Yeah.
But I guess, I mean, this one came first in my head. So, which, you know, this one like really sort of
amazing.
Touched me. Yeah.
Okay. If you want to find Frank, you can find him on Instagram for Frank Barrett. That's B-A-R-A-T. You can also find him on YouTube. Huge recommendation for his YouTube channel, Frank Barrett 77. There's, if you like this interview, there is like new interviews that go up almost like every other day about Palestine, about solidarity. Amazing, amazing stuff, Frank. Thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mikey. I loved talking to you. Thanks, man.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. Stay informed, stay engaged, and never stop asking the hard questions. Until next time, this is Bethany Marks, and you've been listening to This Week in Palestine. If you have any questions or would like to support our work, you can reach out at twippodcasts@gmail.com. A deep and heartfelt thank you to the incredible team working behind the scenes to make this show possible. Special appreciation goes to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Professor Ann Lucas, Sophia Rose Woolman, Lesh Tran, Tahani Abu Mosa, Dr. Rana Awad, Juliet Salama, Hulavier, and Mohammed Alghul. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, broadcasting from WUZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we are grateful for your time and solidarity as we continue to stand for Palestinian liberation. See you next week. Like me can smile.